Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. Our very special guest today is a terrific actor, a really wonderful character actor, and he's been around a long time for a young guy. His name is Matt Servito. I think people most recently remember him from, well, I shouldn't say most recently, Matt, but you're certainly known for your work on The Sopranos as Agent Harris. How are you, Matt?
I'm good. And yes, you're correct. I'd say that is still the calling card, and the thing that gets me in trouble is having been the FBI agent on The Sopranos.
Well, at the end, on the last episode, you actually got caught cheering on Tony Soprano, James Gandolfini's character. And, you know, I think maybe some people thought, oh, you know, God, it went a little too far. But I loved it. I loved the fact that your character was cheering it on. Did you have an opinion either way?
Not either way, but actually that moment was actually lifted from a direct FBI transcript, something that eventually went on trial in New York City. But one of the agents was kind of, I think, found guilty of giving information to some organized crime figures. And it literally did become kind of a New Jersey against New York thing with the agents, with the mob. And so the actual line, if I'm not mistaken, was lifted from a transcript. Eventually, the New York Post did a whole feature on the agent, on the trial. But some of the guys that David Chase knew from the FBI, I think it kind of tipped him off that there was this rivalry between agents kind of taking sides against the families. I loved it. I thought it was hysterical. I've never seen David Chase laugh harder than he did when we shot that scene.
You know, I loved your work, and again, I'm a layperson, so I'm not an actor, but I'm certainly not an FBI agent. But I have a lot of friends who are FBI agents and yeah. Some top guys, and I asked them what they thought of The Sopranos, and they all say Matt Servito. Even before I knew your name, I knew your character before I knew your name. They said Matt Servito is dead on as an FBI agent and a federal agent, and I take that as a huge compliment.
Oh, yeah, and a lot of that was in the writing, too. I mean, as I said, David, had agents, ex-agents kind of vetting the scripts for us, and so I felt there was an authenticity there. And what I like sometimes is that, the sort of everyday, feeling of it wasn't so heightened, in a typical sort of, say, a CSI or a Law & Order episode. There was a lot of scenes that were very just work-a-day, like there's Tony, he sees me, I wave, I go in, I have a sandwich. You're on a stakeout, it's boring, it takes hours, and that element of sort of like he's, a crime figure, I'm an FBI agent, we both know what we're doing here, how are your kids, my kids are good, how are your kids,
Yeah.
I like that sort of sheepdog and Wile E. Coyote relationship that they had near the end. It was great.
Yeah, no question. I agree, and I thought you guys pulled that off as well as anybody did in the whole series, and it was great during the whole series. It was just that type of interaction, and I remember there was a scene with you in the in Satriali's.
Yeah, sure.
And that scene was just great. You were just in there eating, and then you asked about you talked about the terrorism going on,
right.
And that was a conflict scene. That was a scene where he's conflicted because he's an American first of all. He knows you're on the
right.
Other side of it, but now all of a sudden you've switched from. From I guess bureau to another bureau, and here it is. He's conflicted. He hates rats, but you bring up the issue, and it's really a heavy scene. A lot happens there, and I guess in a not so subtle way, but also in a very subtle way. There's a lot going on in that scene.
Yeah, that was the shift. That was where my relationship with Tony shifted because I was you're right. I was in organized crime. And then after 9/11, they put him into sort of an anti-terrorism role. And so now I was no longer chasing him, but I knew him. We were friendly. I come to him, and I'm actually looking for information. And he kind of looks at me like, you're kidding. You're actually looking for information from me. And I said, well, you're an American, right? I mean,
yeah.
I think you want to protect your family. If you know anything, it wouldn't hurt you to pick up a phone and call me. And from then on to the end of the series, our whole relationship kind of took a turn and for the better, because up to that point, I was being spit on in the subways as being, the bad guy on The Sopranos. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I'm the FBI. He's the bad guy. Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, this is Frank McKay, and my very special guest is a special actor. He's terrific at what he does, and it's always great to talk to someone who does what they do very well. And Matt Servito is certainly that, or in that category. And you've seen his work on The Sopranos as Agent Harris, as we've been talking. But you started out in some soaps, and I'm not a soap fan, but you had two roles in some pretty big soaps early on in your career. Is it One Life to Live was one?
Yeah, One Life to Live and All My Children. Yeah, I started a lot of theater training, 6 years theater training with the Juilliard, and my first job was in daytime TV on All My Children, and then went on to One Life to Live. But it's kind of sad. Those shows have faded and disappeared off the dial, but those were great training grounds for, I mean, a lot of great New York actors got their start there, and it was great because it's a factory. I mean, on a show like Sopranos, we'd have maybe 2 to 3 weeks to make an episode. You do one episode every day when you shoot a soap opera. And so there's, you know, you become much less precious about your work. You learn how to hit your mark. You learn how to say your lines and kind of become less obsessed with your performance and more about just getting, you know, the work done. And so it was good training. I mean, it's something that is, people say, God, you can memorize lines so quickly. And I said, that's soap operas. We'd get rewrites that morning of, and we'd be shooting them 3 hours later kind of thing, you know, and, but I worked with so many wonderful, wonderful actors on both those shows. And as I said, I feel bad for a lot of New York actors because it really was a great entry into the television world. Now there's just a couple of them left. But yeah, I had a great time. Great time.
Well, whenever I talk to anyone that landed a gig on a soap opera, I always think the same thing. I think steady work. And I mean, you're talking about steady work. And, you know, I've talked to folks on soaps that were on there for 20 years. I mean, can you imagine 20 years? You think about a guy like Kelsey Grammer, right? He went from Cheers as Frasier Crane and, you know, pretty early on in the same season, the series, and it made it all the way to the end. And then he did another, whatever, 10 years or whatever as Frasier. I always would think that you'd have, you know, almost like a split personality at that point. You're playing the role so often and that every once in a while you'd probably slip into character. Would you imagine something like that happened to a guy like Kelsey Grammer or one of these soap actors that have done it for 20 years?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, for me, I mean, I think it's actor to actor. Variety is the spice of life. So I'm always amazed when I see somebody that, you know, sort of... Well, look, I mean, even taking Jimmy as an example, James Gandolfini, I mean, he ended up playing an iconic role. I think of Carol O'Connor as Archie Bunker. Carol O'Connor was an amazing actor before he started playing Archie Bunker, had a career on stage, he had done films. But when you get handed a character like Archie Bunker, a character like Tony Soprano, Jerry Seinfeld will always be, I mean, he is very much that character, obviously. But
sure.
There's a price you pay. I mean, you will always, you're going to, you know, be indelibly, you know, make your mark on the American psyche as that character. And it'll be very hard for us to let you transition into anything else. I saw that happen with Jimmy. I mean, Jimmy, no matter what films he did after Sopranos, what, you know, TV shows, he was just still Tony Soprano to most people. I said, it was such a shame his early departure from this earth because I felt like it would have taken another generation and he could have made people not forget Tony Soprano, but at least make them appreciate what an amazing performance that was, because he transitioned into that role, transformed into that role. He was not Tony Soprano. I would say he was a nice suburban Jersey kid, you know, Rutgers grad, and I think the character Kevin Finnerty, which was when he was in a coma, yeah. He plays this, it's like insurance salesman from Jersey. That character was actually closer to James than Tony Soprano was. I mean, he had to put on, you know, the whole mob thing, where some of the guys in the show, there wasn't a lot of acting going on.
Right.
But Jimmy, there was, and he really was that good, you know. And that's, I just thought if his career had gone on long enough, there'd be a whole next generation of people that would know him not only for that role, but for his, you know, extended body of work after that.
You're making a very, very good point on that, and that's interesting. You know, it would kind of get a little bit of behind the scene, because I don't think a lot of people know James Gandolfini. You guys do, because you've worked with him, the people over the years that had the opportunity to work with him. But he's certainly a guy who, if you want to call, you know, quote unquote, say make it. He made it, like, definitely later on in life. Let me remind everyone that if you're tuning in now, this is Frank McKay, and my very special guest is Matt Servito, and he is a fantastic character actor, and he's a writer. And Juilliard grad, are you, or did you attend?
No, I
graduated. A lot of people leave.
What are you saying? You've seen my acting. No. Does it look like I finished, or maybe I didn't quite get there to the end?
No, I thought you got one of those soaps in the middle of it and said,
No, the soap came right at the end. I did finish. I did 2 years undergrad and then 4 years at Juilliard. So a lot of training before I finally hit the pavement.
Well, let's start before that. If you don't mind, let's do a little Matt Servito history. You were born and you grew up where?
I was born in Teaneck, New Jersey. We moved when I was a kid to Detroit, where my dad was from, and that's really where I was raised. But we would come back east every summer to visit my mom's family, which was all New Jersey, New York City. And even as a young kid, I just always was fascinated with the city and always had a fantasy of moving back here, either to go to college or to live or to work. So as soon as the opportunity came to apply for college, I had my sights set on putting like somewhere like NYU or Juilliard. And so then I got into Juilliard, came back here to go there to school, and then I've lived here ever since. That was probably almost 30 years ago.
Now, you skipped through a bunch there. What about the first time you got on stage? Was it a grammar school play as a tree or something like that?
You know, I'm always amazed when people say, oh, I knew I wanted to be an actor from the time I was seven, or, you know, young age. And that just wasn't me. I mean, I'm a young kid in Detroit. I think you also, your dreams and fantasies also have to be in the realm of reality somewhat.
Yeah.
And it definitely wasn't realistic to a kid from Detroit that somebody could actually make a living acting or being on stage. I think even being a rock and roll star had more of, because at least there's a big music scene in Detroit. But, I think the first thing was probably high school. I did a musical, did West Side Story my freshman year in high school, and I just got the bug. I really mostly for having doing musicals and actually hanging out with a lot. I went to an all boys prep school, so the only thing we did with our sister school was theater. So, I got in it to meet girls. I think that's why I'm still in it. I meet so many amazing actresses, beautiful women,
yeah.
And get to work with some amazing people. But I really was going down a musical track, and then Juilliard just sort of beat that out of me. I mean, it's definitely a very serious theater training program. I also went, before I went to Juilliard, I went to England for a semester, and I think that's where I fell in love with the idea of being an actor. But as I discovered years later, it was really the idea of being an English actor, because the English let their actors transform. We're much more accepting of letting British actors play a variety of different roles on film and television in this country, and yet our own actors, we kind of don't want them to go too far. We want the bandwidth to be pretty small. You know, we want John Wayne to be John Wayne. You know, we don't really let our character, character actors we do, but many of our stars, we don't want Tom Cruise to go too far off the grid of where we'd like Tom Cruise to be. But the English have a real respect for the craft and for transformation. And when I was studying over there, I just, like I said, I fell in love with the idea of, you know, doing different roles and being in the theater. Their actors could go between stage, film, and television very seamlessly in America for the most part up to that point. If you were a TV actor, you were a TV actor. If you were a film actor, you were a film actor. Now, the walls have come down. When I talk to students, I say it's amazing. You can really do a wide range of stuff, and there's no judgment. I mean, when you have Oscar winners doing commercials, when I was a kid, that never would have happened. You never would have seen, you know, Robert De Niro pitching a cologne or seen, you know, George C. Scott selling a car. It just wouldn't happen. These are Oscar-winning actors. They would never, you know, lower themselves to doing a commercial. Now you can do anything, you know, a wide range of stuff. So
you're still not seeing Dustin Hoffman or Tom Cruise sell cars, right? I mean, it's probably, you know, price range, you know, is part of it too, I imagine, right? If those guys are getting whatever, 15, 20 million a film, they may be a little, you know, I don't want to say snobby, but I mean, they may be a little more difficult to land them on a Super Bowl commercial, even if it's for
you know, you can be selective. But then, of course, you know, there's a whole website dedicated to foreign commercials that George Clooney, Brad
right.
Pitt, you know, all do you think,
yes.
you know, these guys know George Clooney has made a fortune overseas. You know, he sells scotch in Japan. He sells watches in Italy, you know, cars. So they just won't do it. They don't show them in America.
Yeah, I stand corrected. You're absolutely right.
No, that's a very new phenomenon. I mean, that's not that new, but You know, you sort of felt like, oh, these guys would and gals would never do that. And then you come to find out, oh, wait a minute, they've been doing it for 10 years somewhere
right.
else. You know?
Right, yeah, I stand corrected. No, that's you're absolutely right. I'm going to remind everybody once again, if they're just turning on their radios or they're just tuning in, I am speaking to Matt Servito, and this is Frank McKay. Matt Servito, most people remember him for movies like Hitch. And if you go way back, you're talking about All My Children and One Life to Live. But I think for the rest of your life, a lot of people, at least, are going to remember you as Agent Harris on 24 episodes of The Sopranos. And it's just because it may be the best show of all time, the best episodic show. And, you know, it's certainly in the argument. It's certainly in the conversation. It's become either the Godfather and, you know, I guess... maybe because of the mob theme, it's easy to say Godfather, but where Godfather or Citizen Kane, you know, they're always one or two. The Sopranos, you hear people say Sopranos and Seinfeld and, you know, and certainly Breaking Bad now. What do you watch, Matt? What is it that you do when you're sitting in front of the TV?
I got to be honest, I don't have a lot of time.
Yeah.
I have three kids, so what do I watch? I watch Dora the Explorer. but when I have time, my wife and I are big Homeland fans. Just getting into the new season on that. We watch Game of Thrones. I feel terrible. I just started Breaking Bad. You know, so much time goes by. I feel like, you know, we are in the golden age of television, especially of cable television. And I've even read, one of the TV critics for, I think, New York Magazine wrote a great article saying, basically waving the white flag. He says, I give, I can't, my DVR is full. When I first started as a TV critic in this magazine, there was only one or two good shows, Sopranos, The Wire. There was only a couple that I was writing about. He said, I truly am amazed at the quality and the explosion of quality on cable television, so much so that I admit that this reviewer does not have enough time to watch all the shows that I should be watching. And I feel the same way. I have friends on shows I literally run into, and I almost get embarrassed to look them in the eye. I'm like, your show's in its like third season, and I have yet to see an episode. Like, don't worry about it. That's what the DVR, that's what Netflix is for. So...
I'm the same way. Hey, listen, I got four kids and the same thing. It's just recently that I've been able to say that I don't watch Dora or the Explorer. I'm thrilled about that. You're going to appreciate it once it goes by. It's very nice. But you are one of the people, and when I interview people that have been on The Sopranos or Breaking Bad, I could actually talk about their shows. But there are hit shows that I would probably love. When I interview somebody, I just have no idea what the attraction is, just simply because I haven't gotten to it. And I think you're right, and you bring up an excellent point about the reviewer. We have about 3 minutes left in this segment with Matt Servito. Matt, do we have you for a second segment?
Sure.
Yeah, great. I'm thrilled to have you. I've always admired your work, and I think you made the right choice going into acting rather than music. So many people that I talk to or that I just know personally that have done really well in music, their kids are going into visual mediums, either as actors or filmmakers or some type of, like I said, visual medium, because it's easier to get paid. If you're out there writing songs, I mean, it's hard enough to get paid for writing songs in the first place. But now with the illegal downloads, it's a lot easier to make a living in the visual medium. Would you agree or disagree?
No, I agree, and I am concerned because I feel that the days, I mean, it's already happening. It was, pirating music early on was very difficult because the files were very large, and you'd have to stream all night to just get a couple of songs. Well, then technology advanced, and now you can, pirate songs in an instant. The same thing is happening with film and TV. It was very expensive and almost impossible to pirate an entire movie. You'd have to have your computer running for like 3 or 4 days to load an entire movie. 10 years ago. And now again, with the technology, it's almost instantaneous with streaming. So, I'm afraid for my union. I'm afraid for my fellow actors. I mean, you're right. It is. There's a certain longevity that comes with being an actor, if you're lucky, that you can sustain a career. But, one of the issues I know for my fellow actors and myself is, trying to continue to get paid and get our residuals for, movies and television, especially if people start, quote, stealing it. I mean, in the end, we've all kind of done a little bit of it, but it is stealing, and that's the hard, not paying people for their creative work is really a travesty. And, You know, we all seen what it did to the music industry. I mean, it is decimated. It's eviscerated, and there's not much left to it. And you know, sooner write a song, it's gone. You know, and I think they only make their money touring now. So, but I think you're right. I mean, I remember when the choice for some, you know, like Kirk Gibson, when I was a kid, he was a football star, but he went into baseball, and he said it was strictly about longevity. He says, yeah, I probably would have had a few good years of football, but I ended up having a lot more good years of baseball, and I feel the same way. You're right. You could have a couple of good years as a rock and roll star or as a musician, but you can have a long career as an actor, if you know, again, if you're lucky and you can grow old, you know, as I as I am. Clearly, the camera's showing that.
Yeah, you look good, and I'll tell you, people are living to 100 nowadays. It's funny you bring up Kirk Gibson I know you're a Detroit guy,
yeah,
and you know, hobbling around those bases, I can imagine how long Kirk Gibson would have lasted as a tight end with those knees. We're coming right up on a break, and Matt Servito is going to be back with us right after this break. This is Frank McKay. We will be back on Breaking It Down.
Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone back to Breaking It Down. Our very special guest today is actor Matt Servito. This is Frank McKay, and I have the pleasure of speaking to someone who has the great fortune and certainly earned his way there to be on one of the great shows of all time, The Sopranos. He played Agent Harris on The Sopranos. But if you go way back, you can remember him from some work on All My Children, One Life to Live. His movies include Hitch, and you did a movie, I'm trying to think, it was with, you were terrific in it, Patton Oswalt. It was such a disturbing movie.
I love that.
Big fan.
Yep.
Wow. That was a disturbingly dark movie, but that was good. And you were terrific in it.
First of all, he's great to work with. In such a serious role, too, which was a lot of fun. I mean, he was not a cut-up between takes. I mean, really stayed in character, and somebody who, comically, I've just always loved. And I was so looking forward to just having a ball with him on set. But it was, a very dark film. And he kind of chose to really stay in character and not be the cut up between takes that a lot of the funny guys are, you know. And but when I've done a few independent films that I always recommend to people, big fans, one of them, and another one is called Two Family House, which
terrific.
That's another
Michael Rispoli. Michael.
Yeah. A lot of Sopranos people on it, and it won the Audience Award at Sundance the year it was out. And it's just every once in a while somebody come up to me and say, you know, I know you're on Sopranos, but I got to tell you, I saw Two Family House on the IFC channel or, you know, Sundance channel. It is so good. And I said, it's really, truly one of my favorite projects. I always tell people, if you haven't seen it, rent it. It's just a film with a big heart, not, you know, no sex, no violence, just a good story and a lot of good acting.
That was a terrific, terrific movie. Wow, yeah. Was that good.
Vinnie Pastore, Michael Rispoli, Catherine Narducci, these are all Sopranos alumni.
Yeah, and that's something that happens. There's such a cult following in The Sopranos that people gravitate towards the films. But the thing is that was nothing like a Sopranos episode. And Rispoli, even though, and I've had Michael Rispoli on the show a couple of times, I think he's just a terrific actor. But I didn't see him as Jackie Aprio playing that. But then again, he was only in four episodes.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he didn't have that same stigma that would have been attached to James Gandolfini. When I saw Not Fade Away, I think it was Not Fade Away, I had a hard time watching it. And I hate to say that because I love David Chase and I love, you know, all the guys in that film. Yeah. I love Gandolfini. But I didn't see it as anything else other than as like a bizarre Sopranos episode, you know?
Yeah, and it was very, very different, very different. But really, I mean, that's David. David is a very complex guy. And just when you think he's going to do something one way, he's a contrarian. He'll do the opposite just to sort of explore that. And I mean, even just in the writing on the show, people would felt the show should go one way. David would take.
Let's talk a little bit about David Chase, right? We're both big David Chase fans. Tell me what he's like. Tell me what he's like on the set. Is he a delegator or is he the opposite of that?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I worked with David and for David for a lot of years, the whole run of the show and of The Sopranos. But in an odd way, I ended up learning more about David Chase after the show was over in magazine interviews. And I'm being very serious. Sure. He's a very private man. He has I think I mentioned earlier, has a delicious sense of humor. I'd love to see David do a comedy. It's the one thing he's kind of not done, and yet I think he's got a great dark sense of humor. I'd love to see him find a script that's just got his sense of humor, because it's kind of twisted and dark and funny. And you saw some of that on The Sopranos. I mean, some people's favorite moments, you know, are these kind of really funny moments with Paulie Walnuts or with Christopher, you know, the conflict between the two of them.
Yeah.
But David is he's a very private person. He was not a control freak on set at all. David directed the pilot episode, and David directed the last episode, and everything in between he just was very good at bringing very talented people in and leaving them alone, letting them direct, letting them write. And you see it, as you know, we were mentioning earlier, you see it in the alumni, the people that directed the show, got their start on The Sopranos, and then went on, and they're doing, you know, Rome, they're doing Game of Thrones, they're doing all the big HBO series.
Boardwalk Empire.
And you see the writers. Matt Weiner goes and creates Mad Men. Terry Winter goes off and does Boardwalk Empire.
Tim Van Patten did a lot of work.
Tim directed a lot of stuff. He's just always working now. Kessler. He went off and did Damages. So like I said, David was just, he's got a great eye for talent. And even just in his casting choices, like when he with the show, so many people said a network would have never cast the show, you know, the way David did. They would have shot it probably on a back lot in L.A. He was very insistent about the show being shot in New Jersey.
You would have had Jimmy Smits, and all due respect to Jimmy Smits, you would have had Jimmy Smits doing Tony Soprano if it was shot on the network.
I think one of the network's execs said we probably would have cast Ted Danson. I could see that. I mean, Ted Danson's a good actor. That's probably
who they
would have cast for a network version of The Sopranos.
That is funny, but that is very, very true.
Oh,
they would have
absolutely
done something. Let me take this moment to remind everyone that this is Frank McKay, and our special guest today, again, is just a terrific, I mean, hyperbole aside, a great, great character actor, Matt Servito, and most people are going to remember him from his work as Agent Harris in The Sopranos, or at least I think that most people are going to remember. You've done so much work over the years. Do you see, and you're just getting into Breaking Bad now, I think you're going to see in that, because I watched all of Breaking Bad in the last season, but I went nuts. My wife goes to sleep earlier than I do, and the kids go to sleep earlier than I do, and I'm up all night, and I've got insomnia, and I'll put it on as background while I'm doing paperwork or I'm working on something. And I saw all of those episodes in like a month's time. I just went nuts watching it, and I saw a lot, especially the interaction between the husband and wife. And the struggle with the crime and everything else, especially in the wife. I saw a lot of Sopranos in that. And it's going to be interesting to ask you the questions after you see the whole show, how much of it was there. But to me, how can you not, if you're doing Breaking Bad, how can you not be influenced by the Sopranos?
Of course. And I think, you know, and what's interesting is, I mean, and it's a show that ends up getting compared a lot. And it's interesting. To be honest, I want to go back, which I haven't done, and watch Sopranos again. I mean, I keep saying to my wife, you know, we watched the whole thing, obviously, once and watched whole seasons again twice. But I said to her, you know, it's been a number of years now. I feel very removed. After Jimmy died, I sort of had this, you know, thing of like, HBO started airing Sopranos again after its long run on Bravo and A&E and, you know, in syndication. HBO got the rights back, and they've been running the episodes uncut, you know, the original cuts. And I just came across an episode one night, and I just was like, wow. I know it's similar to people saying when they're playing, you know, shoving a microphone into Peyton Manning's face and say, hey, you just broke the touchdown record. You know, it's like, look, I'll think about all this stuff when I retire. But really, right now, I just want to win the game, keep moving, try to win another championship. And so many of these sports guys just say that. Like, you know, maybe someday I'll sit down and look at my rings, look at the photos, and it'll all mean something. But right now, I just want to keep playing basketball. I want to keep playing baseball, football. And I know we all felt that when we were doing the show. I mean, even just in my, you know, middle, I was not a lead on the show, but I was there for the whole run. And just the experience of it was very much, Like, we were just making a show. Even as the show was growing in popularity and, you know, the critics started to really kind of talk about it as one of the best shows ever, you never would have sensed that on the set. It really was, we just want to make a TV show and just keep going. But, like I said, all of a sudden you come across an episode and I go, wow, this really is, you know, this is that good. I only see it now, like having watched so many other shows since then, come and go, and even acting on so many other shows since then. But it really is that good. And I said to Moira, I just, you know, as much as we are backlogged on a lot of series, I'd love to go back and start at the beginning, which is amazing to me, is almost, what, 17 years ago? 90, what did we start? 97, 98 was the beginning. And just start and go all the way back through, you know. Because it truly, like, I think I'd watch it with a fresh eye. And what's fun is there's a whole new generation of fans. I just was talking to a bartender last night. Kid couldn't have been more than 24. He did not see them when they aired. He's just been streaming them, Netflix, probably HBO Go, the whole series, and he just talked my ear off. And I was like so happy because this is how these kids are going to see them. They're just going to binge watch them, just as you were talking about with Breaking Bad. And I love it. I love when I meet young guys and gals that come up and like, oh, I got to say, you're the agent. Oh man. My girlfriend and I, we've just been watching Sopranos. You know, we were kids when it came out. We weren't allowed to watch it. We love it. We love it. And so I'm just happy to see a whole new generation, you know, catching up on it.
It's got to be exciting. Reminder, once again, Frank McKay here, and my special guest is Matt Servito, a wonderful character actor, and we're talking about his work in The Sopranos and much, much more. Let me ask you this. I guess there were, 64 episodes? What was the what was the final number? Was it 64?
What was odd is we did the last the last season was a short season. I think it was 9 episodes. So, let's see, 60. Yeah, it's like maybe 67, something like that.
Okay, 67. Let's call it 60. We'll even round it out to 68 if you cut that in half. How much like doing 36 movies was this, or, you know, 34 movies was this, compared to doing a TV show?
You mean like just in regards to the content or the time it took to shoot it?
Well, the approach to shooting it. I mean, you obviously knew it was going to go on. You knew it was going to go on for a while. Yeah. Hey, we got another season here. Obviously, Tony's not going to die. And this isn't going to happen. We're not going to lose Tony. Right. We know that. But you're not sure who you're going to lose. But how much of it, I mean, I looked at it like almost like little movies. I mean, each one you could watch as little movies. And I'll go back to the point, and I was making this point earlier to my producer, is that even if you take the episodes that are my least favorite, if I watched it standalone, I'm like, this is terrific. I mean, this is just the worst Sopranos episode are better than much of what's out there. And to me, They're like little standalone movies almost. And, you know, the perfect example, I had Burt Young on the show. Sure. That episode was very movie-like. You remember the episode with the Mustang Sally or whatever, the guy wraps him.
Right.
First of all, you had a whole bunch of new characters that you had to absorb there. And then, you know, it was taken care of, you know, by the crew. You know, Tony Soprano ultimately had to give the decision. But really, that was a little movie. I mean, that was a little movie. Did it feel like that while you were making it, or did it always feel like a TV show?
Yeah, I first want to address your point. What's funny is, I mean, just like any other fan of the show, there's some episodes to me that are not as good as others. And I remember when the show was airing, I'd get an earful from different friends. And it's funny, I think, you know, what's fun to go back and watch is, as you said, even those episodes that I remember watching in the moment, because I was so emotional when they were first coming out, that, you know, you wanted every episode to be amazing. And so when you wanted that heightened moment of somebody getting whacked or a tense moment. And some episodes were very pedestrian, very suburban. Tony, just his life, his wife, the cars overheating, you know. Everybody's waiting for something to happen, and nothing. And the episode would end, and I'd get a call like, "What was that? What was that episode? And nothing happened." And I said, "Well, you know, not every episode, but like you said, if it came on right now, I'd be absolutely engrossed." And as you said, even that episode now, with no emotional attachment, I could sit and watch and go, "That's a great look at the detail, look at the camera work." And as you're saying, going into your second point, the film quality, the camera work, our DPs, our directors. All kind of lent a very cinematic quality to the show. And we also had the luxury. It's funny because some of the shows I've done since are on a much tighter schedule. I mean, we, you know, as much as we want to feel like we're shooting a movie, we move so fast, you definitely have a sense you're on a TV show. As Sopranos went on, David began to get more and more production days out of HBO, so that by the time we did the last episode, I swear we must have had 20 shooting days, which is obscene. I mean, one of the shows I've been doing recently, I think we barely have 9 days for the same amount of content, like 55 minutes of content. And, we, you know, so we really had the luxury of doing slow, you know, work, lots of takes, crane shots, you know, car, you know, drive-by stuff where you've got car, you know, cameras mounted on the cars. Really felt like we, I mean, and it just, oh, and we, and because we were on location, that to me, I mean, New Jersey and New York are another character in the show. I know that's very cliche about when people talk about great films and movies, but, you know, talking about location, but truly, if they had shot that on a back lot in New Jersey, or when people try to double Toronto, Canada as New York City, you, a New Yorker will know it immediately. And even if you're not, even if you're not in New York, you look at it and you go, doesn't look authentic. It doesn't. Everything looks clean. Everything looks very, you know. And so, the being on location, you know, at Citriale's, being on location under the Brooklyn Bridge, being on location in the Meadowlands, in the swamps where they're chopping up a body, it adds. So, I mean, when you're as an actor, you're standing there and you're like, look at this, man. We're under, you know, we're under this overpass in the swamps with a car backed up. It's darkly lit. It looks amazing. So you always felt like you were just, you were like you were in the coolest film ever, you know, week in, week out. A lot of, but like I said, but also mixed in with that were plenty of just very simple episodes. And that was David's writing. David loved to kind of like keep the fans guessing. People would, you know, there's still all those open-ended storylines. where's the Russian? Where's the rapist? What happened?
I
don't know. If you still have those things kicking around, I still, which is amazing to me. That's great art, right? Years later, I'm still getting the same questions, you know, because people are still obsessed.
Yeah, well, you brought up some good points. I forgot all about the Russian. We have about 5 minutes left with Matt Servito, and we're talking a lot about Sopranos here, but of course, he's done quite a bit more than that. This is Frank McKay, and I want to ask you this question. Maybe this is like the big question everybody asks you all the time, and it's becoming real cliche. But what do you think would have happened if James didn't die? Would there have been a movie? I mean, is there any chance there would have been a movie, or would there have been another follow-up, a big situation? What do you think would have happened? And I know David Chase answered this question somewhat. You know, that Tony didn't die, but it was, you know, he gave some kind of answer in Vanity Fair or something. But what do you think would have happened?
Yeah, to that point about David in the magazine, I'm still not 100% convinced that his answer was that direct. And that, I mean, knowing David the way I do, I mean, he would never be so blunt and about something that is unanswerable and really didn't need an answer. And David has said for years to all of us, don't ever feel like you have to answer that question. Is Tony alive or dead? Don't worry about it. That's for them to think about and then to obsess about. We just decided to leave it, you know, ambiguous and cut it off where we did. But to your your first question, I mean, we've never would have done a movie. I think that ship had sailed. I think that, Jimmy really had kind of, you know, I think he wanted to spend, you know, the rest of his time trying to, as I said earlier, trying to get people to move on and let him be other characters, let him be other roles. Because you do that movie, you're only reinforcing what is already there. And, you know, and really, Jimmy and David made good money doing the show. They didn't need the money. And neither one of them are the kind of guys that would have sacrificed quality for money. I mean, you know, if it would have compromised the integrity of the Sopranos image and Sopranos story, they never would have done it. I mean, and the only thing I did hear, and I can't remember if I heard it directly from David Chase or if I heard it as hearsay from one of the writers, but I jokingly said something to somebody about the movie, and I want to say it was one of the writers said, you know, the only thing that David ever mentioned was a prequel, that he wouldn't be so much interested in continuing with the same characters, picking up from where maybe the show left off or even a year or two down the line, but maybe going back 15 years to like maybe the early 80s, mid 80s, and exploring some of those characters. And Tony's a young kid. He's like in high school, or maybe he's in grade school, and sort of where things, where his family is at that point. Because David was always very interested in the character of the mother. Mm. And, you know, to see
that was his mother, you know, in his mind, right? That was he talked
yes,
about that.
Yes,
being...
very, yeah, and I mean, really, that is David Chase's right. Yes, his working through his own mommy issues with his yeah. writing. I think he would have loved to have gone back and seen the mother as a much younger woman, stronger woman, and sort of how her psyche comes about. So that was it. I mean, like I said, if David would have done anything, it would be something interesting like
he could,
that.
He could still know? Do it. We got about a minute and a half left with Matt Servito. Hey, Matt. Let me ask you about your pretty face is going to hell. Now this is you as Satan.
This is me as Satan. It's not even a subtle like. Are you Satan? Are you no? I am the devil. I've got horns. I'm half man, half goat, with yeah. hooves, and it is. It's all set in hell, and it's the classic hell you imagine with like fire and lava, and it's all done with green screens. And I describe the show as Sesame Street on acid. It is. It's got puppets. It's got crazy special effects, and it's a very simple, funny show for like probably high school kids up to like college. That's our huge part of our audience. And
what's the distribution? What's the where is it? Where is it airing on?
It's on Adult Swim.
Great.
Which is it's on the Cartoon Network after 8 o'clock becomes Adult Swim and. It is truly a delight to shoot, and I've never had as much fun. I mean, talk about this opposite of Sopranos. I mean, heavy makeup, green screen, crazy scripts, lots of physical comedy, and as I said, I am hell is basically an office. Everybody has to wear polo shirts that say hell on them with khakis, and they all work in cubicles for Satan, and so for all eternity. So it's truly it's basically the office is hell.
I was hooked at Satan, so I'm gonna definitely check it out.
When my agent said, "Hey, you have any interest in going in for this? You know, the role of Satan?" I said, "Stop! I my mother will be so appalled," which means I want to do it.
Yeah, very good. Hey, Matt, where can people follow you? Do you have a Twitter? Are you into social media? Website?
I am. Yeah, I'm quite simply Matt Servito on Twitter. My full name and on Facebook as well. There's a fan page there as well on Facebook. So
let's just spell out Servito. It's Servitto.
Yeah. So Matt Matt and then Servito S as in Sam Erv as in Victor Itto.
Terrific. Matt Servito has been our very special guest. Matt, we got to do a part two one day. We'll talk. Hopefully we'll be talking about your pretty face is going to hell as like. In the same category with The Sopranos one day and Breaking Bad. Actually, I don't know about that, but it sounds like it's going to be fun. It sounds like
I would love to talk more about hell, Frank, anytime.
Matt, thanks for being here.
Hey, all right, Frank, my pleasure. Thanks again.
Matt Servito, everyone. This is Frank McKay. We will see you next time on Breaking It Down.